The hour 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order. We do not have a quorum at this point, but we will be starting with House File 573. When we do have a quorum, I'll be moving that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record, and as soon as we get a quorum, I'll actually move your bill. So when we get a quorum, we will be interrupting you. But if you could have your testifiers please start to provide their testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dwayne Quam. I'm representative for House District 29A.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 573 is to take care of what too frequently happens. Legislation and standard practice are in effect for many years, and then an agency decides to interpret in a different way than what has been standardly interpreted, and that we have to go back through legislation and clarify and return original intent to a process. This has to do with taxing durable medical equipment components. And I will let the my testifiers get into the details.
Okay, if you please introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. My name is Jackie Anderson. I own Key Medical Supply.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And with me is our VP of Sales, Sarah Anderson.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Representative Quam did a really nice job of encapsulating the key point of this, and that is that we are trying to correct a situation that is and has been impossible for us to implement. And it all stems from two points. One, that the definitions of the products that revenue has put into the tax code is different than the definitions that are used in healthcare and have always been traditionally used in healthcare. They are defined under the Medicare and Medicaid programs in a different way. And that makes it really impossible to get to what they're attempting to do here. The other point is that Medicare, Medicaid, and third-party sales of medical supplies and equipment historically in Minnesota have been exempt. And when this law was changed in 2005, there was no mention that that exemption had changed. And it's only been through field sales tax audits that those of us in the industry are finding out that this law changed apparently in 2005. The change was not explained in tax bulletins that are published annually, and so there was no need for us or no indication to us that that was different. And so through these sales tax audits, we of course had appealed, and we won on that point, that because there had been no notification, they couldn't hold us to the tax. And so starting in April of 2009, the sales tax bulletins did include that exemption for third-party Medicare and Medicaid not to be there any longer.
Okay, so if we could just hold that thought, and you'll continue in a second here. I'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. I will move that House File 573 is before us. And before we get before we have further testimony here, Representative Myra will move the minutes of March 3rd. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. I will be calling back from the Property Tax Division House File 112, a Barrett bill, House File 680, a Biskins bill. We do need to send those other places before they actually come back before us, so that I would move that HF 112, a Barrett bill, goes to jobs and be moved to Jobs and Economic Development, and House File 680, a Biskins bill, be sent to Transportation. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails on moving Biskin's bill to where it needs to go.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, with that, Ms. Anderson, if you could please continue.
Okay, so our bill before you, House File 573, attempts to correct this, as Representative Quam stated. In doing so, what we did is take and suggest that the definitions under the Medicare and Medicaid programs under the Social Security Act be used. And so in the underlined portions, you will find that those definitions. They are extracted, as I said, just from the way that they are written in the Social Security Act. The other thing that this does is it corrects items that, now we're going to get a little technical here, but it corrects items that under the program rules are prosthetic devices. Under Minnesota law, those are exempt. The definitions used, however, by the state of Minnesota now take those prosthetic devices and make them single patient use DME. So that corrects all of that as well. The other thing that we have in the legislation is the definition of insurance or third party insurance, third party payers, and that is taken from statute 62A.01. And so those are the definitions that you see on page 3 and 4. And they include things that under the definition as they're used in that section of statute, they exclude things that have to be included in our coverage. In the medical world, there are coordination of benefits that occur. And so all of the various iterations of insurance have to be included because they can overlap or be used in sequence depending upon the individual. And so those are the changes that we've made to this law.
Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Is there, just to get a show of hands here, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on behalf of the Quam bill? Is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns? Okay, any questions for members, for the witness, or the author? With that, we will... Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I was reading this, one of the things is that I recall right on the sales tax, we have a streamlined, we try and work our a sales and use tax, streamlined sales and use tax agreement. How does this fit in with that? Because I know that's been an issue.
Either Ms. Anderson or Ms. Dalton could handle that.
Well,
Ms. Anderson,
I'll just give you my my information that we have. We've met with revenue on this, of course, and that SSUTA compliance has come up numerous times. And there are options under the SSUTA parameters. And what we're suggesting is that the option for compliance with exemption of third party be chosen. And that's what this law provides.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Good, thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Dalton, could you clarify a few things on that, please, for Representative Kiffmeyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, there's a number of things in this bill that, although written the way they are, violate some definitions in streamlined sales and use tax agreement. With some rewriting, they could be made in compliance. But the definition of what the carve-outs for what can be exempt in durable medical equipment, you either have to make all durable medical equipment exempt, or you can limit it to one of the following three things, or a combination of one of the following three things, which is by prescription only, because it's purchased by Medicare or Medicaid, or for home use. However, you are not allowed, there is no carve out, as it were, for third party payers for the insurance companies.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Okay, that's very interesting, Mr. Chairman. And when I hear the word it could be rewritten so that it could be, that's kind of an indication that maybe it should be if we were going to use this kind of action to do.
That would be an indication that Representative Quam might want to visit with Ms. Dalton and get some things clarified. Representative Quam. Or Ms. Anderson.
I just wanted to say that you know we've done research on this as well, And it has been explained to us, and it is our opinion that the third-party area can be exempted. The Medicare and Medicaid exemptions are there in SSUTA. What we're saying is that the complexity of health care requires that that also extend to insurances. And so I understand that we have this SSUTA thing that we're trying to comply with, but we also have the business reality of what we're dealing with, and we have to live in that world. We have to live in that world. And we have spent an incredible amount of time and money and resources trying to figure out how in the world that we in this industry are going to comply with this. And we're telling you, I'm telling you right now, and our organization that I'm a part of, representing the medical supply and equipment people in Minnesota, there is no way for us to comply with this. The definition changes that have occurred in the original legislation from the true reality of how things operate in our industry are too cumbersome. There is no way for us to comply. When you take an item that under healthcare definition is a prosthetic, all of the support items that are required for that piece of equipment to operate and function properly are also considered necessary prosthetic supplies. Under this law that we have on the books right now, they are single patient use DME items and exempt. They are taxable. They are no longer exempt. And so we're looking at things like oxygen masks. We're looking at things like drain bags that have to collect the output. We're looking at catheters. We're looking at enteral feeding bags and tubing that you need to connect the food product to the food source or the opening in the stomach. Those things are now taxable. We're also looking at kitted components, and there are a lot of kits in healthcare. We are looking at having a cumbersome and onerous and unenforceable situation where we have to look at the components of these kits and determine which are taxable and which are not. Even though we buy them as kits, we sell them as kits. So there's no way for us to do that. There's no computer system that will allow us to do that. So we're asking that our representatives take all of that into consideration and help provide the relief that we need.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that was an excellent explanation as to why this is valuable legislative policy, and certainly appreciate that. I think the other thing is that I heard in this unenforceable, so compliance and audits and all the paperwork and the burdens that it takes to do all of that. So I certainly appreciate that explanation. That was very, very helpful. So thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a question either for Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael. the argument has kind of been made to move forward with some of these changes regardless of their impact on the streamlined sales tax, that getting this to work better for the business community should be primary, and the state's involvement with streamlined sales tax secondary. What would be the implication of changing this in the way that's contemplated in the legislation, even if it violates streamlined sales tax policy and rules?
Ms. Dalton, did you hear Representative Dabney's question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, maybe it would be easiest if I explained what could be done that would not violate it, and then what could be done in a broader sense that would also not be in violation. Anything that is not defined by streamlined sales tax definitions, and that would include these accessories and supplies, can be granted a separate exemption in state law without violating streamline. However, we cannot put it in a definition of something that has been defined. So as it relates to these accessories and supplies for durable medical equipment and prosthetic devices, we could actually write a sales tax exemption for accessories and supplies of durable medical equipment and prosthetic devices, since they're not defined for streamlined. That's an allowed exemption. that the state could do without violating it. We can do the language that says anything purchased by Medicare and Medicaid is exempt. That is an allowed exemption in Streamlined, and a number of states actually do that right now. We are one of few states that don't do that. However, to affect the third-party payers, we would essentially have to exempt all of this, which we do for everything except durable medical equipment. So this is really just a durable medical equipment issue as it relates to the third-party payers. And that's the only thing I think that we have a problem with, a violation of Streamline that we can't overcome.
I would suggest, Representative Dabney, you still have the floor, but I would suggest Mr. Quam and Ms. Dalton and the two Ms. Andersons maybe talk after committee. Representative Dabney.
I'm good. Thank you.
I know you're good, but do you have any other questions?
Is that on tape?
That's on tape. That's on the record. Okay, with that then, I will lay over House File 573 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Mr. Representative Quam, if you and the two Ms. Andersons could please meet with Ms. Dalton. It sounds to me like we're maybe not that far away here. Okay, thank you. And while Representative Slawik is coming to the testifying table, I will... I'm referring the following bills to Property Tax Division: House File 825 Marquardt, House File 832 Lincheski, House File 841 Bisgins, House File 861 Runbeck, House File 869 Nelson, House File 877 Simon, House File 890 Quam, House File 896 Fritz, House File 902 Dill, House File 909 Murphy, House File 910 Murphy, House File 916 Hilty, House File 930 Falk, House File 942 Hilty. So they are now in the Property Tax Division. Is that in the packet? And that should be in your packets if you're looking at what each of the bills is about or what they would do. Okay, we have House File. I will move House File 772, the Slawik bill. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today we have House File 772, and this is a bill that I've carried for the last several years. It's a modification of the dependent care tax credit. And members, we know that in Minnesota more than 75% of moms are working, and this, as a result, many families are using child care. We also know that child care can be really expensive. As some of you know and have personal experience, is that it can often cost more even than college tuition. I'm going to give a brief explanation of the bill, and then I'm going to ask our testifier to talk about it from there. What this credit does, it ties the refundable state-dependent care credit to the non-refundable federal dependent care credit. The state credit amount would equal the federal credit amount that individuals are unable to use to offset federal liability because their income is too low to result in federal liability after allowance of the federal credit. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'll have our testifier.
Thank you, Representative Slawik. Can you please state your name for the record and who you represent, please?
Yes. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Nino, N-I-E-N-O-W.
It's spelling the last name?
Nino, N-I-E-N-O-W.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We are a statewide coalition of child care advocates working to increase the affordability, accessibility, and quality of child care. I'm here today to support House File 772, the modification of the Dependent Care Tax Credit. Child Care Works knows that this credit is one of several important supports designed to help low and moderate income Minnesotans afford quality care opportunities for their children while they are working or looking for work. Although we know that investing in the early years provides some of the greatest returns of any public policy area, with today's budget deficit, new investments in early care and education are unlikely. Linking the state dependent tax care credit to the unrefundable portion of the federal dependent care tax credit means that 10,000 more families in Minnesota will be able to better afford and access quality child care. In Minnesota, most of our young children are in child care settings, whether it's a child care center, a licensed family home, or with a family member, friend, or neighbor. About three quarters of Minnesota's families with children under the age of 13 regularly use some type of child care arrangement, and over 360,000 children spend some portion of their day in a licensed child care setting. a large barrier to quality child care is the cost. Most families who use child care have significant out-of-pocket expenses. Households with low incomes shoulder the biggest cost burden relative to their incomes. For upper-income families, child care will usually take up approximately 7% of their income, while for low-income families, child care can cost up to 30% of their gross income. At the same time, families with young children are usually at a low point of income earnings, given that they are likely in an early stage of their career. Expenses can range widely depending on the age of the child, the type of care, and the geographic area of the state. For a family with a preschool-aged child and an infant, full-time care averages between $15,000 and $24,000 in the metro area and $12,000 and $16,000 in greater Minnesota, depending on the setting. And that's more than double the cost of annual tuition at the University of Minnesota. It's not hard to see, then, that the cost of child care is a huge concern for parents of all income levels, but especially low-income families. Offering parents support to meet this need is good policy, and the range of assistance options, including those through tax credits, help families make use of the assistance that best meets their needs. The Dependent Care Tax Credit is designed to offset the cost of care for parents when they're looking for work, and the benefit is when they're working or looking for work, and the benefit is designed to address the needs of low-income families, as it is targeted to incomes below $36,980 and is fully refundable. While tying the unrefundable portion of the federal dependent care tax credit to the state credit will not completely close the financial gap that many families feel as they struggle to pay for child care, it is significant assistance and could be the resource that allows a family to choose a quality setting for their child. In greater Minnesota, child care settings are fewer, and often families have the extra burden of traveling great distances for access to care, and considering the increase in gas prices, that adds to the cost. These non-metro families are more likely to claim the dependent care credit than our metro area families. Child Care Works urges you to consider the opportunity created by the Dependent Care Tax Credit in helping Minnesota families, particularly those who are lowest income and rural, as they participate in or seek to enter the workforce. As Minnesota's workers, their investments in our state, local, and federal economies is critical now and should be supported, and the care setting for their children is often their greatest priority. Minnesota can and does support both interest through the Dependent Care Tax Credit, and we urge you to strengthen this support, this important support for Minnesota's working parents. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Before we go to questions, is there anyone else that would wish to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns on this bill? Okay, questions for Ms. Nienau, for members. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nienau, you said that this bill will allow access to quality child care for, I think it was 10,000 families. What are those families doing now?
Ms. Nienau?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins. A lot of those families probably are making use of our child care assistance program, whether it's through the basic sliding fee scale or if they are on our MFIP program. So many of them are receiving assistance, but we also know that families that either don't qualify or don't apply for child care assistance often rely on family, friend, and neighbor care, which certainly can be quality care, but often is inconsistent and unreliable. It makes it difficult if grandma can't watch the children every day or a neighbor can't be there after school to watch the children. So it really depends on the family's working situation.
Representative Biskins. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slawick, I'm just kind of looking over some notes here, and it says that on the federal credit, it doesn't phase out after you reach a certain threshold. Can you give me a better idea of what that means for Minnesota, what our current threshold is, and what that would mean ongoing-wise, cost-wise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, so I make sure I get this right, I am going to refer to Nina Manzi, who has worked on this bill as well.
Ms. Manzi?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the federal credit phases down from being 35% of qualifying expenses to being 10% of qualifying expenses. What happens with the federal credit is that as a taxpayer's income increases, they start to have federal tax liability and they begin to be able to use the federal credit to offset their federal liability. So under the proposal for lower and middle income families, the state credit would equal the unused portion of the federal credit. As income increased, then people would be able to use the full amount of their federal credit to offset federal liability at the federal level, and the state credit would go to zero. So I haven't worked out exactly what income that happens at, but I think it's going to be between $40,000 and $50,000. So the state credit under the proposal would be limited to households generally with incomes under around $50,000.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mancy, what is our current threshold then for receiving the credit that we have?
Ms. Mancy.
Income-wise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the current state credit begins to phase out when income is at about $24,000, and it's fully phased out when income reaches $37,030. So the proposal would make the state credit available to a higher income range of people.
Representative Anderson. Okay, with that, I will lay over House File 772 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Representative Slawick and Ms. Nienau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill we have, we're fortunate today to have House File 674 with us, Representative Liebling. If you could please come to the table. Okay, and so I will move House File 674. So that is before us, and I believe, Representative Liebling, you have an A1 amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, if you could move that as well.
I will move the A1 amendment to, it's H0674A1. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That gets the bill in the shape that the author would like. Representative Liebling, welcome to the Tax Committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing this bill. This came to me from a constituent, and I thought the best way to sort of explain to you what this does and why it's would be a good thing to do is just to read you the very brief email that I received from the constituent who said, "One suggestion I have is that on income taxes, the allowed underpayment of $500 on the annual return be increased. It's been that for many years. Meanwhile, there's been inflation and complexities added for taxes, and it is rather difficult to estimate taxes by January 15th to avoid penalties. I wouldn't mind paying enough to be sure to be safe, but then the feds punish me by calling the refund income on the 1040 form on the next year's federal return. That means more of my Social Security is taxed and my medical deduction is reduced by 7.5% of the income. Increasing the allowed underpayment means I wouldn't have to overpay and suffer the consequences." So members, I think what essentially what this bill does is that right now you have basically for taxpayers who have to do estimated taxes, you have sort of a you have to make sort of a Hobson's choice between you have to guess what your pretty accurately what your estimated taxes are and pay them pretty accurately, because if you underpay by too much, you get a penalty, and if you overpay, you have potentially other ramifications, as this constituent is suggesting. So what I'm trying to do is raise the sort of the grace area that you get when you do your estimated taxes from $500 to $1,000. It was set at $500 in Minnesota in tax for tax year 1985, so quite a while ago. At that time, it was the same as the federal. But in taxable year 1998, the feds raised it to 1,000. So we don't have to comply. It's not a conformity thing like we sometimes think of tax conformity, but it would make it simpler for taxpayers to have the same level. And It's just, I think, a sort of a taxpayer-friendly move that just takes into account that, we've had a lot of inflation since 1985. And I didn't know when I filed the bill what the revenue estimate would possibly look like, but from what I understand here, the revenue estimate explains that it basically just shifts some money from one year of the biennium to the second year, just because of the initial change. And maybe Ms. Mancy can probably explain this a whole lot better than I can if there are any questions on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Liebling. Yeah, Ms. Mancy, if you could kind of explain that on the revenue note here. And members, you have that in your packets here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it appears that the revenue note assumes that the bill would become effective relatively soon. The revenue shift is, if you look at the second bullet on the bottom of the revenue estimate, it explains that there would be a one-time impact as the April and June of 2011 estimated payments would not be made by the 30,000 taxpayers who meet the $500 test but would not meet the $1,000 test. And so those taxpayers would then instead pay their tax. It would show up in their final payment next April, so in April of fiscal 12. So it has the $44 million going away from fiscal 11 from estimated payments that would be made this April and this June, and then it reappears when these people file their returns and make their final payments in April of 2012, then showing up in fiscal 12. I don't know that this would become effective soon enough for people to not make their April 15th estimated payments. So I rather think that that part would probably stay in fiscal 11 based on when tax bills tend to be enacted. The June payment, if this were enacted, say, in May, then there may be people who wouldn't make their June estimated payments, so a portion of it might move from 11 to 12, but I kind of doubt that it would be the entire $44 million.
Representative Liebling, I like what you're trying to do here. We're just going to have to work on some timing, I think.
Right.
Representative Kiffmeyer, then Runbeck. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was going to be my comment as well, that I really like the idea of it, but if there's a way that we don't straddle fiscal years just for a variety of purposes, if it could be written in a way, and I don't know, Ms. Mancy may be able to suggest how that timing could be done in such a way that we don't cross those fiscal years.
Ms. Mancy, can you suggest something? I'm with Representative Kiffmeyer on this one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, Mr. Michael and I just consulted briefly, and it seems to us that if we delayed the effect of this until the September 2011 estimated payments, then the June 2000 estimated payment of 2011 would still be made in that month, and all the fiscal 11 money would stay in fiscal 11, and then we would have the increase going forward. That's something where we would want to draft some language to do that and have the Department of Revenue take a look at it and verify that we had, you know, accomplished what we intended.
Okay, and we don't need to do that today, but I think that's something we should be doing here. Representative Runbeck. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Kiffmeyer.
No, that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Runbeck.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, to that point, I mean, maybe we just make it effective December 31st, 2011, because you're still going to have tax preparers that have sent out all of their estimated tax coupons for the year, you know, 2011. So you're going to have that's going to necessitate, you know, still some sort of amendments on their part. I would just push it back till the end of the year.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Liebling? I like what we're trying to do here. Thank you very much, Representative Liebling. Any closing comments? Or
no, Mr. Chair, just that I appreciate the hearing, and, you know, I think this is something that, you know, we can all kind of agree on that's good for taxpayers and really has no downside that I can see for the state.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mancy, is it senior citizens who, for the most part, are affected by this, or is it across the board?
Ms. Mancy.
I'm talking about seniors who are receiving their Social Security, and that's taxable in Minnesota.
Ms. Mancy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, it would affect senior citizens receiving pension income, Social Security income. It would also affect people whose income was from a small business, whether as a sole proprietorship or a pass-through S-corp or partnership, who don't have withholding, so they're required to pay their tax on estimated through estimated payments rather than withholding.
Person of Erickson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Those of us who live debt-free and are, you know, receiving these, we have to do this.
Yeah. Any other comment? Okay. With that, I will lay over House File 674 for possible inclusion. The Omnibus Tax Bill, Representative Liebling, if you could follow up with Ms. Manzi or others to try and get that so we can do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we'll go to House File 410. I will move House File 410. That bill is before us. Representative Lohmer. And Representative Lohmer, to get the bill in the shape she would like, has an A1 amendment. I'll move House File 410, then I'll move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 410 before us as amended. Okay, if you could please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee, for considering House File 410 in this committee. This bill has to do with taxing of Social Security benefits. As you can see from the handouts that are being passed out, Minnesota is one of only seven states that taxes Social Security benefits. We are essentially taxing our senior citizens twice on the same money. So I've amended the original bill to phase this in, this exemption over the next 10 years to limit the impact that it would have on the budget. But I believe that our seasoned citizens have the right to their own money without further taxation. This was something that was brought to my attention by one of my constituents on the campaign trail, and as I looked into it, I believe it is the right thing to do. I value our senior citizens, and I believe the more incentives that we can give these folks, the more likely they are to stay in Minnesota and spend their resources here instead of elsewhere. So just a quick explanation of the bill. The bill would allow a subtraction of taxable Social Security benefits from Minnesota taxable income and from the Minnesota alternative minimum taxable income. So the subtraction would be phased in starting at 10% of benefits in the tax year 2011 and as proposed be amended, increasing by an additional 10 percentage points each year until 100% of the benefits would be subtracted in the tax year 2020 and subsequent years. So today I have with me several testifiers that live near me, one from Woodbury and one from Cottage Grove. And so I'd like to first introduce Mrs. Judy Wolf.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Judy Wolf. I live in Cottage Grove.
And is Wolf W-O-L-F or is there an E at the end?
W-O-L-F.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Lohmer, for inviting me here today. Mm-hmm. I am a widow. I live on a very fixed income of Social Security and part of one of my husband's pensions. I was very surprised to learn that we are only one of seven states who taxes Social Security. And I feel like Representative Lohmer does, that people work hard all their lives and they pay taxes on their income to begin with. Why would we have to pay a tax on it again when we are living on fixed incomes? I guess that's my testimony.
Thank you. You have another testifier?
Yes, I do. I have Mr. Lanny Lundquist from Woodbury.
Please state your name and if you could please spell your last name for us.
My name is Lanny, L-A-N-N-Y, Lundquist, L-U-N-D-Q-U-I-S-T.
I welcome the committee.
Yeah, thank you for having us. I too thank Representative Lohmer for inviting us. I talked to her on the campaign trail. She came to my door and we mentioned some of these things, but I hadn't really thought about it too much until tax time came around. My wife and I are both in a situation where we're just retiring in the last year or two, and she's a couple years behind me, but I'm learning about Social Security, and one of the things I learned was that my Medicare was coming out of my Social Security, and I wasn't really even aware of the tax on Social Security until it was brought to my attention. Just yesterday, I went in and talked to our tax preparer, and I would say we're a pretty average income. Income is being reduced, so things are getting pretty tight for us. So every dollar now is getting to be more and more important as it becomes more fixed. And I had my tax preparer just run it through her computer. What would my taxes look like if this bill did not exist? If we were not taxed in Minnesota on Social Security, and it came out to $619. And that was actually substantially more than I thought it was going to be. So it does have a, doesn't break the bank, but it has a major impact on our income. And I would just urge you to consider this problem as for seniors like us as we retire.
Okay, is there anyone else that would wish to testify on behalf of the bill? Before we get into member questions, anyone that would wish to testify with concerns on the bill? Okay, with that, I would like to introduce from Representative Hackbarth Country, members of the Elk River Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the Tax Committee. Okay, Representative Loon and then Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to thank you, Representative Lomer, for bringing this forward and your testifiers for making your case. And I think this is something that many of us hear from constituents about when we have a gathering and people are letting us know what's on their mind. I had a question, and I'm not sure if best to direct it to you, Representative Lomer, or to one of our researchers. I noted in the revenue estimate it said about 296,000 tax returns would be affected. So obviously that's about the number of people who are receiving Social Security benefits this would impact. I'm wondering of those, if we know how many that is really their primary source of income is their Social Security benefits. Is there a way that we could break that out, or is that something that we would know?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, that is not something that I know right now, but I think that's something that I can provide you on an estimate of. So that when I prepare this, if you could tell me someone what breakpoint you would consider using to determine if someone is receiving most of their income from Social Security benefits. Are you thinking someone for whom, for example, 75% of their income is from Social Security benefits, or 90% of their income? All of those are things that I could make an estimate of using the income tax sample and just running through all the returns in that sample, and then they get weighted to be the population to see how many returns there are where it meets, you know, whatever criteria you want it to use. So maybe we can visit about that after committee.
Thank you. I'd be happy to do that. And I guess just from, you know, for the benefit of the committee, I'm thinking out loud here that a breakdown from 75% up to those that are 100%, I'd be interested in seeing that. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Rukavina, Loeffler, and Carlson. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, just for a point of clarification for myself, when, you know, the 6.25 or 1.5, whatever it is, that a person pays as their part of their Social Security, is that pre-tax? If you take it out and then you pay your state and federal taxes on top of that, or are there federal state taxes on the whole income before that comes out?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, as an example, if someone has $50,000 of wages, then the 6.2% of that is withheld for Social Security, and that $50,000 of wages is reported to them on their W-2 and counts as income for that year. So both taxes are applied to it.
Okay. Representative Rukavina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if I'm looking at this chart, I'm assuming was done by you or someone else, Ms. Manzi, from the Rawls Research. And we're looking at the retired married couple, retired single worker. It seems to me that you know, when you get up in the total income over 71, 141, or even before that, in the 55, 400 to 71, 141, I'm looking at the retired married couple, you know, the family that's still working that maybe is making $40,000 a year would be paying on all of that income, whatever it's taxable, and yet you would have people, particularly over $71,000 of income, that are getting $22,800 not taxed at all. So it would be like working families paying to make up this revenue estimate of $315 million cost over 4 years. Am I correct in that assumption?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, both the retired couple receiving Social Security benefits of the and total income of $43,400 and a working couple with $40,000 of wage income would get to apply the appropriate standard deduction and personal exemptions and claim itemized deductions and whatever else they were allowed under the tax law to reduce that before reaching their taxable income. That $43,400 is simply the total income level at which a portion of the retired couple's Social Security begins to be included in taxable income.
But I'm saying, Mr. Chair and Ms. Manzi, if this bill is put into law, then the couple making, retired couple making between 43 and 55 get to deduct immediately 22/8 of income and don't pay taxes on that, right? I mean,
Ms. Manzi?
So theoretically, it's the young couple starting out instead of the older couple like myself at the end of my life where I don't need that much money. I'm eating rabbits and venison and you know what I grow in the garden, so, and I don't have that many payments anymore. So, you know, I mean, I guess my point is income, if you believe like I do, it's a CFL, that income is income no matter where it comes from. We're shifting the burden of now our income tax liability in this state to make it less aggressive in the sense that, you know, a Johnny Letch starting out or a Tara Mack that are starting a family are going to be subsidizing this in a sense with their income. Am I incorrect in my assumption?
Representative Rukavina, if you could talk to the microphone, please. Ms. Manzi, to the Rukavina question.
Mr.
And I hope you're not towards the end of your life.
Chair, I'm getting there.
Are we going to vote on that?
Yeah. I think I can win that one, Garofalo. Make the motion. Make the motion. Come on.
Let's do it. Make the motion. Euthanasia here.
Ms. Manzi, to Representative Rukavina's lifespan.
Don't go there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, this bill would make the overall amount of state income tax revenue smaller. So it would make, if you think of state income tax revenue as a pie, and you think of certain slices of the pie being contributed by retired people and working people, the pie would become smaller, and the wedge of the pie that's paid by working people would be relatively larger compared to current law, and the wedge that's paid by retired people would be relatively smaller compared to current law. I do want to point out on the example, the couple who's making $43,400 doesn't immediately start having the full $22,800 included in their income right when they go over that level. It begins to phase in, and at most only 85% of that $22,800 is ever included for the couple with the income over $71,141. So it increases by 50 cents on $1 for each dollar of income over that $43,400. So for somebody at, say, $45,000 of total income, really only a small portion of that $22,800 of Social Security benefits are included in their taxable income.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then am I correct in saying that for a couple making $200,000 a year that are both making maximum Social Security income, they're going to really get the break on this as compared to a couple that has a $50,000 income that are getting maybe $1,000 a month in Social Security.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, that's correct. That just higher income.
Another
yes.
Tax the poor and let the rich off scheme.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, that sounds true. I'm dying over here.
Representative Loeffler or Representative Lohmer?
Well, to that point, Representative Rukavina and Mr. Chair, I just have a few points here. RetirementLiving.com lists states according to their per capita ranking for taxes, and Minnesota ranks number 2 for total taxes as a percentage of income. Kiplinger.com says this about Minnesota's retirement appeal. Minnesota offers cold comfort on the tax front to retirees. So, you know, we see Minnesota doesn't exist in a bubble. Retirees have choices about where they can live and so where they can retire, I should say, and how to stretch their money. So while we're not really the worst, we're certainly not the best, and I just think we need to face that reality. And the Tax Foundation took information from the Census and IRS to determine net migration from each state, and last decade Minnesota lost a net total of 24,000 taxpayers. So I just think these are things to consider in this bill. And, Mr. Chair, is it appropriate at this point? I do have another testifier, or do we want
to
wait?
We've got three members who would like to ask questions first, and then
okay.
we'll go to the testifier. Representative
right,
Loeffler, and then Carlson and Anderson.
Mr. Chair, could I just...
You still have the floor. I'm sorry, I didn't come back to you. Representative Rukavina.
Representative Lohmer, I have no problem with you trying to help out. Is it Mr. Lundquist? You were a pretty good hockey player, too, weren't you, or whatever? But anyway... And Ms. Wolf. But the point being that the way this bill is drafted, they'll get a little bit of help because they're in the lower to middle income, and people making 150, 200 grand a year, they're getting the maximum Social Security, are the ones that are going to get most of the benefit. And then the rest of the people, these young people up here from the Chamber of Commerce that are just starting their life working, are going to have to pay for it. That's just the point I'm trying to make. And that's the choice we make around here. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of am kind of a Robin Hood kind of guy, and I admit it. I did cheer for Robin Hood instead of the Sheriff of Nottingham when I watched the movie, and depends who you want to cheer for, I guess. So.
I kind of like the sheriff. I support law enforcement. Representative Loeffler.
You know where I sit.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rukavina pointed out, clarified some of my confusion about who does this really apply to. I'd really love to see, though, what percentage of seniors getting Social Security this would have any impact on. Because if the average benefit is $22,800 per year, and they can earn up to a taxable income of $43,400 from other sources, it seems to me that this would be a pretty small portion of our seniors. But the other question that I think was a little bit confusing was, as I read the House research brief, it appears to me that there are only 28 states that have an income tax exemption for Social Security benefits, and that the reference to the six states is just because there's six states who handle the partial exemption exactly the way we do, which is paralleling federal law. And is that correct, Ms. Manzi? So it really is, that's the definition of the six. It's not that we're the only six left. It's just we handle it in parallel to the federal tax provisions.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, I think that it's seven states in total that tax Social Security benefits. Minnesota is one of six. There are six states that include Social Security benefits in taxable income on the same basis as they're included at the federal level. There's one state where it's similar, but they use a slightly different income definition, and that's Montana. And then the remaining states either don't have an income tax or they explicitly exempt all Social Security benefits or they exempt a portion that are included at the federal level. Or they have there's a listing on the second page of Representative Lohmer's handout that goes through and tells you how many states do what. And it is only seven states that include Social Security benefits and taxable incomes, pretty much the same way that the federal government does.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think that, you know, we have tried to parallel federal policy when we can, but it was kind of confusing, all the different maps, and it looked like there was a whole variety of things. But I do think, you know, given that our average pension, I think, is less than $18,000 a year, and if our average Social Security is $22,800 for a married couple, it appears to me that the majority of our seniors already qualify for this benefit, and that it really is the higher income seniors that we're talking about. And I'd really like some demographics or the deciles on that. If we could get that from revenue, that'd be great. Or if Ms. Manzi can run it out of her amazing database.
Ms. Manzi, can you help out Representative Loeffler there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I can't run it on the income, on the population deciles that are in the incident study, if that's what you're thinking of. That uses a larger database of households in Minnesota. It includes households that are not that don't file income tax returns. My database is just of income tax returns. I can provide you with some information of how the benefit of this proposal would be distributed across income ranges. So I'll plan to do that for you.
Thank you.
Loeffler.
Thank you. I think that's really useful. And if we can accommodate how many seniors don't file, because I know a lot of them don't have an income even sufficient to be required to file. So if we can adjust for that, that would be great, too.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Carlson, and then we'll go to the next testifier.
Mr. Chairman, I also have a question of Ms. Manzi, and what I'm sitting here thinking about is that the memo that we have and the bill deals with Social Security, but if you're under an approved pension plan, you don't come under Social Security under federal and, I think, state law. So would we be treating one group of retirees differently from another group of retirees depending on the source of their pension? And I guess that's of
Ms. Manzi.
She's worked on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it's correct that individuals who weren't covered by Social Security but were covered by some other arrangement, such as federal retirees, would not be affected by this bill and would continue to have their retirement, their pension income included in taxable income.
Representative Carlson?
And I think it goes far beyond just federal employees. For example, teachers that were hired prior to 1979 came under an approved pension plan in some of our cities, at any rate, and we're not under Social Security. I'm just asking the question of, you know, should something be done? Should it not be a question of treating all pensions, regardless of source, the same, would be the point that I'm making or asking about. Another one would be railroad retirement is technically not Social Security, at least by name.
That's different.
I don't mean to develop a whole list of different retirement plans other than to say that there are other plans out there where a lot of retired people wouldn't necessarily be drawing Social Security.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it would be an issue with regard to, like, state employees and the groups you referenced who are not covered by Social Security but do have their own pension plans. Railroad retirement is a little bit different because federal law prohibits the states from taxing railroad retirement benefits, so there is in our state income tax already a subtraction for the full amount of railroad retirement benefits.
Carl?
Mr. Chairman, well, maybe we could, depending on the outcome of this, get a broader picture. I just learned something about railroad retirement then, but my only point is that if there are other pension plans out there that, at least according to this memo, wouldn't be covered by this bill, and there would be an equity question in terms of the source of your pension that would probably be necessary to address if this were to move forward.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Kiffmeyer, then we'll go to the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say that I heard Representative Loeffler mention the states and the chart and so on, but just from our official bill summary here, 37 states fully exempt Social Security benefits from taxation. 3 other states have generous retirement income exclusions that may result in Social Security exemptions, and Iowa and Missouri are phasing in a full exclusion currently. That adds up to 42 states. And so I think definitely the statistics in regards to, but in regards to all the other pensions, there are three states that have retirement income exclusions. I think they recognize the value that retirees bring to their state, the volunteering that they do. The kids and grandkids come visit Grandma and Grandpa, so they bring a little income spending. And so I think there are a lot of reasons why folks see the value of some of these pensions. But instead of not doing this one, because if some others should have it too, it might be good to do all of them. And I think your point, Representative Carlson, is maybe we should look at that sometime in the future. But this is a bill right in front of us now. So thank you, Representative Lohmer, for bringing it forward. And I think the statistics show Minnesota's going in the right direction.
Okay, we have someone else who would like to testify on the bill, if you could please join us. Are there any more questions for Ms. Wolf or Mr. Lundquist? Okay, thank you very much. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Phil Krinke, the Taxpayers League of Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I will be brief, Mr. Chairman, because I know you have many other things on the agenda. First and foremost, for my friend, Representative Rick Avina, he seems to have forgotten that the Sheriff of Nottingham was the government and was exploiting the people, and it was Robin Hood who was fighting against the confiscate...
Arms for the revolution.
The confiscatory government, Representative Rick Avina. So, anyway,
Mr.
just
a
sidelight, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted
keep
to
yourself under control.
I'm trying. I got so excited when they were talking about Representative Rick Avina's demise, I could hardly control.
Oh, my. Mr. Krinke.
He loves me.
Members, I think that Representative Lohmer and others have a tremendous idea brought forward today, talking about not taxing people's nest egg, not taxing people's retirement. Again, I think Representative Carlson brought up an excellent point. This legislature has dealt with issues of taxing military pensions, taxing police and fire, and other retirement benefits. Certainly, this is an opportunity to take a major step forward, not to tax people's retirement incomes. Again, we all know that the demographics of the state of Minnesota are changing rapidly. We're going to have more and more retired persons. And contrary to what Governor Dayton wants to do in terms of punishing people who may want to continue to live in Minnesota and yet winter in other states or other places, again, Representative Rookie, I think we had about 75 inches of quality of life so far this year, with a few more on the way. And so this isn't necessarily the best place to hang out in the winter months. And there are people who decide they want to reside in other locations during several months of the year. So rather than punishing those people, I think it would be tremendous to reward people who want to stay in Minnesota, add to our communities, add to the vibrancy that we have across the state of Minnesota by investing their volunteer time and so many other things that seniors provide for our communities. So also one other point, ladies and gentlemen, to take into consideration, this type of legislation where we're moving away from an income tax based system and would be an opportunity to consider whether you want to go to a broader based consumption tax, as I said, and move away from the confiscatory type of taxation you have for people's pensions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative Krinke. This is great to see you. As always, no, Representative Krinke and I, former Representative Krinke and I, are good friends, even though we probably think about 180 degrees opposite. But I'm glad you brought up a consumption tax, because that's okay, you know. You know, that low-income family that's got to buy clothes for their kid to go to school should pay taxes on that. But now somebody making $300,000, a retired couple in income, should get another tax break because it's based on income and ability to pay instead of non-ability to pay. There's no choice. You know, I knew that when I was when I was young, that's a long time ago, and had a young family,
I could see the pressures on my kids to have what other kids had. And I hated the fact that I had to buy Air Jordans and flashing shoes and everything else. But, you know, if you didn't get them, your kid got ridiculed so bad in school, you had to make the choice. You know, there are a lot of choices that you think are easy to make. I'll buy the cheap tennis shoes instead of the expensive ones for my kid, or the, you know, common ones that are a fad now. But those choices aren't that easy. And so to become more regressive and have a bill in front of us that, you know, by revenue, the estimate is going to cost close to $400 million over the next 4 years, it's, you know, I mean, it is definitely your philosophy. You believe people should be paying fees and fines and sales tax and et cetera, and not pay based on income. And you and I have a different philosophy on that. But you did throw out the tax word right there, consumption tax. You want it to go from fairness to unfairness, and I don't think it should. You know, and Representative Krinke, while I have you on the stand, this is great. You're on the Board of Trustees. Are you going to be proposing as a trustee member that we cap tuition or cut tuition or have a number on tuition increases at the Minsky system?
Well, Representative Rukumi, maybe you could have that conversation later.
Well, we need to
talk about Lomer bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, tuition is a tax too on our people.
We're talking about Social Security today, but I would suggest you two
eventually
get together
afterwards. Beyond Social Security, so there's a stop.
Real soon, Representative Rukumi.
Any other questions to the bill? Otherwise, we're going to move on. Okay, I will lay over House File 410 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Lomer. Okay, I'm going to recall House File 674, the Liebling bill, over for possible inclusion. I don't think I said as amended, and we did amend that bill. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I will now lay over House File 674, the Liebling bill, as amended. Now we'll go on. My good friend, Representative Hornstein, House File 665. I will move House File 665 so that it is before the Tax Committee. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your hearing this bill. Just a simple, non-controversial tweak to the corporate franchise bill, and I seek your support. No, joke. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein, I think.
Just for the freshmen, be wary when they say that. Mr. Chair and members, so seriously, thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss this with you. We had a lively discussion in Tax Committee last year, and as well as on the floor. And so I think many of you, especially those who've been in the legislature last year, are familiar with this, so I don't want to go into too much detail other than to make a couple of points in terms of why I think House File 665 is even more timely this year than it was in the past. And Mr. Chairman and members, this gets at what I call the problem of hidden spending in our budget, which are the all the tax expenditures. And this certainly qualifies as a tax expenditure. I understand that we don't have a revenue estimate, but based on last year's bill and some figures from the Dayton administration's budget, we're talking about an expenditure, hidden spending, in the amount of $250 to $300 million. And I think it's also hidden spending on two levels, because Madam Chair and members, this bill also deals with foreign operations, foreign royalties, and tax havens. And so we don't really know exactly how much money is being lost to the state of Minnesota. That's confidential information. So these are just based on estimates. So we're talking about hiding spending on a couple of levels. And so, members, the issue here that makes this, I think, more timely and a little bit different than in the past is the fact of the matter that not only do we have a record deficit, but we also have the corporations that are doing very, very well. Very, very well in comparison to when this bill was first proposed and signed into law. And that was done actually in the Perpich administration. This bill dates back to the mid to late 1980s. I don't know exactly the date that it was proposed and eventually signed into law. But we had a very different economy, very different corporate structure back in the 1980s than we do now. You know, I did some checking, and after Black Friday, the October 1987 stock market crash, the Dow was at 1,738.74. We had corporations at that time that were just beginning the process of locating in foreign countries and globalization, and maybe at that time this was potentially for Governor Perpich a very valid incentive for that. But you know, times have changed. In those days, you know, the NASDAQ was still this emerging from this small over-the-counter market, transitioning in the 90s and today to this high-tech powerhouse. And so we no longer, I would argue, need this type of one can call it incentive. I call it a hidden spending mechanism for these large multinational corporations. Now, let me just, as I become close to concluding here, make the point that was raised in the Star Tribune just on Sunday, an article in the Associated Press written by Matthew Kraft and David Randall. And these authors assert that corporations are expected to make record profits this year and have enough cash, $2 trillion, to pay bigger dividends and start buying back shares of stock, both of which make stocks more valuable. And then here's an interesting quote from Joe Davis, the chief economist from the mutual fund giant Vanguard. Corporate balance sheets haven't been in better shape in the last 200 years, period. So, to conclude, this is kind of an anachronistic 1980s tax policy. It needs to be updated. And as a matter of fact, on a bipartisan basis, Madam Chair, this was updated both in 2003 and 2007. In 2003, under a Republican legislature and Governor Pawlenty, already there was some agreement that this idea of foreign operating expenditures and were some corporations were certainly abusing this, and we were losing revenue for the state of Minnesota. It was further tweaked in 2007 under a Democratic legislature, also Governor Pawlenty. So now we have the next permutation, which would be a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor making further reform and further change. And so then, just very briefly to the bill itself, there are three sections or three different tax expenditures that are addressed here: foreign operating corporations, foreign royalties, and tax havens. And the tax haven one is the one that seemed to draw the most interest last year. You'll recall that Representative Broad had some objections to Barbados being included in the list, so we took that out. She was right. The Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, which put out this list, Representative Broad had pointed out, had dropped it 3 months prior to my bill. We had some objections from the government of Latvia. The ambassador came and met with me. He made the case that they're not a tax haven, and so I enjoyed that. And then Representative Huntley got a very assertive letter from the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg arguing that they shouldn't be included, so they've been taken off. So I'm very flexible if any of these governments, although Lebanon, I'm not sure I want to meet with Hezbollah, but any of these governments, if they come to me, you know, I'm open to their arguments about why they're not a tax haven. So I have a one exhibit one, if you will, Mr. Chair.
Exhibit one.
Ms. Herring has the map of the world. These are all the tax havens. You can see there's a concentration of tax havens in some of these tropical islands, both in the Caribbean and the South Pacific, and of course some of the smaller entities in Europe, countries in Europe such as Monaco and others also are tax havens. Andorra, for example, a tax haven in Europe. So to conclude, members, we have our constituents work hard. They play by the rules. They pay their taxes. I think it's high time that we stop this practice of hiding assets overseas These assets belong to the people of Minnesota. They do nothing in terms of creating jobs and building our economy here. They're just being hidden off in the tropics somewhere. And I think this is something that has had bipartisan support in the past. I hope we can get bipartisan support currently, and I think this is an important part of how we address our budget deficit. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members. I do have a couple of testifiers, and be happy to answer your questions. I know I have another bill downstairs that at some point I might get called away for, but happy to take your questions or if you want to take testimony
Let's go with testifiers first so we can have all the testimony, and then we'll go into questions. Looks like a great place for some annual meetings, however.
Yeah.
Okay, who is there anyone, first of all, that wishes to testify for the bill? If I could see a show of hands.
I think I have three, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Ms. Thorson, Ms. Shawbuck, and Mr. Smith.
We'll bring them down first, and then anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on the Hornstein bill? Okay, we've got a couple. Okay, please bring your witnesses to the table, Representative Hornstein.
Yeah,
or testifiers.
I don't know who would like to go first. Maybe Mr. Smith, and then we can have the other.
Could you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir?
Chairman Davids, members of the committee, I'm Dane Smith, president of Growth and Justice. We're a policy research organization focused on broadening prosperity in Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to speak in support of HF 665 and make just 3 points about reducing this costly tax expenditure. One, we do live in an increasingly interconnected world of corporate globalization, and we have nothing but admiration at Growth and Justice for our largest corporate citizens and their ability to compete in this global marketplace. But our public investments by our state and local governments right here in Minnesota also are good for business in the long run, and those governments are in dire need of revenue. A continuing no new revenue solution to our budget situation actually represents a greater threat to jobs in our communities and our economy than a balanced approach and realizing some of these tax expenditures. It would be nice not to have to take away this break, but there are a few alternatives, especially if we don't raise revenue from personal income. And this kind of tax expenditure for offshore operations seeking havens is one of the few types of revenue sources that former Governor Pawlenty actually sought and approved. Secondly, this option has the benefit of not being a general tax increase, but closing off a legal but apparently unintended exploitation or of a tax avoidance loophole, and it would not affect most of the struggling tens of thousands of our mom-and-pop operations or small, medium, and micro businesses. Most of our homegrown small businesses can't play this game, and many, I'm sure, would argue that it's not fair to them as they try to compete against these much larger businesses. Third, we have very little specific evidence that these breaks are of a net benefit to Minnesota. Business in general has not been held accountable or reported back to us on jobs created for these more exotic forms of government subsidy or support. Nor, for that matter, do we have much of an accounting of the many numerous corporate, business, personal income, and property tax breaks that have been dispensed over the last 25 years in Minnesota, and which have crept in since the sweeping federal and state tax overhaul in the mid-80s under President Reagan. While it is probable that these special breaks and loopholes help create some jobs, and that the cash from the tax breaks is not certainly or entirely responsible for the dramatic redistribution of income that we have seen to top earners over the last 30 years, we are just not aware of any reliable or comprehensive detailed studies that show the extent of actual job creation here in Minnesota and benefits to Minnesota from the hundreds of millions that are not being paid. We do know that recouping some of those lost revenues would avert further damage to middle-class families that benefit from our schools and our colleges, our roads, our other infrastructure systems, assisted living facilities, hospitals, and the economic safety net. Finally, I'd just like to draw your attention to two new, highly credible and reputable sources of information on tax expenditures. One is February 2011 Tax Expenditure Review Report I think you're probably aware of this. It's the latest report. It has the additional value of a panel that recommended that tax expenditures be brought into the budget process in a more systematic way, that tax expenditures be evaluated for their actual benefits, and it even recommends sunsetting some tax expenditures. The other is a brand new hot report called Beyond the Bottom Line. It's produced by six blue chip foundations in Minnesota. It lays out redesign and government accountability measures, big ticket items that the legislature and the governor are encouraged to pursue. And Mr. number Smith, three on their list is tax expenditures.
Who is that study from, Mr. Smith?
It was actually written. It's primarily the work of the Public Strategies Group, which is a highly reputable national firm that studies government effectiveness. Peter Hutchinson used to be a principal in this group. And the six foundations that financed it include the Bush Foundation, the Blandon Foundation up in northern Minnesota, the Minneapolis Foundation, Northwest Area Foundation, St. Paul Foundation, and the Minnesota Community Foundation.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, and we'll go to questions for Mr. Smith. First of all, to Representative Hornstein, are there any other states that have passed a bill similar to House File 665?
Mr. Chairman, members, I believe there are. I don't have those at my fingertips. It's possible that Mr. Michael may know, but I know that this has really become an issue both at the federal level and the state level.
Mr. Michael? I'm sorry, Representative Hornstein.
Yeah.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, there are three states that have provisions like this. Montana is the state that this is the most closely modeled after. The other two states are Alaska and West Virginia.
Okay. And to Mr. Smith, I've got one quick question before we go to other members' questions. The current FOCs and foreign royalties and all the things that we're trying to curtail here, they're legal today, isn't that correct?
Chairman David's members, yes.
Then I have a concern when we say special breaks, exploitation loopholes, when they're simply obeying current law. How is it exploitation or special break when it's the law?
Well, I think I would say, Chairman, that members of the committee, that the law is often exploited, and I might have chosen a different word. They take advantage of it to an extent.
How do you exploit following current law? If they're following current law, how is that an exploitation? For example, if I don't get my charitable contribution deduction or my interest on my home deduction if I had a loan on my home, how is that a special break exploitation or a loophole? Are you saying that a home interest deduction is a loophole? I mean, the Hornstein bill, we're talking about tax expenditures, which the Hornstein bill is looking at. But if I deduct my interest, am I exercising a loophole, a special break, or exploiting something?
I think, Mr. Chairman and members, there is a great body of investigative journalism and research that suggests that these laws are indeed being exploited in ways that were not anticipated.
But, Mr. Smith, if you're following current law, how is that an exploitation?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what to say other than it happens all the time in the real world.
It happens all the time.
Laws are exploited to an extent we didn't anticipate.
But how are you exploiting something that's legal? If it's current law and legal, where's the exploitation? Those are pretty powerful words.
Yeah.
Special breaks, exploitation, loopholes. I don't think that my home interest deduction or the FOCs, if companies are following it properly, is an exploitation, a special break, or a loophole. Those are very negative connotations when companies are following current law.
Well, I've tried to, Mr. Chairman, answer your question the best I can. If it's not...
What was the answer?
I'm saying that there's a great body of research and material out there that explains in detail how corporations and other entities exploit the law. The law,
but
exploitation of the law.
Mr. Smith, they're following the law. How do you exploit something when you're acting in a legal manner?
Apparently, I don't have a satisfactory answer, Mr. Chairman.
I don't think you have an answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Members, questions? Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll save my questions till after we've heard from all testifiers.
Okay, thank you. We'll keep you on the list. Okay, thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you very much. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did not have a revenue note in my folder. Is there one distributed? There isn't one. Do we have an approximation from the author or any testifier? Yeah. And
maybe we can bring Mr. Mossman down from revenue to see what he can do that question. And if anybody else that is going to be testifying, if you're using words like special breaks, exploitation, and loopholes for following current law, you're probably going to get the same questions that Mr. Smith received. Because I'd like an answer when we're following current law, how we're exploiting something. That's not for you, Mr. Mossman. That's okay. The question for you, Representative Groffel, could you please repeat the question and see if Mr. Mossman can give us an estimate here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Mossman, do you have a revenue estimate or an idea of how much in taxes would be raised by this if we were to enact the 665?
If you would please state your name for the record and then answer Representative Groffel's question.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Revenue, Department of Revenue. First of all, just apologies to the committee. We just have some staff out sick that were unexpected, so with the scheduling, we haven't gotten that, and we'll get the estimate both to the author and to yourself as soon as possible. The best source of information I would have for you would be that the two provisions, certainly with regard to repeal of the foreign royalty subtraction and the FOC preferences, I think at this point until we have a revised number based on the new forecast and cleanup would parallel. Those are similar to what's in the governor's budget recommendation, and so I'm looking at that budget page that the change in revenues for those two provisions would be about for the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium would be about $272 million. For the 12 and 13 biennium. I did talk to research staff, and I'm guessing that would be the bulk of Representative Hornstein's impact for his bill. Also, the tax havens language we think would be a modest change relative to current law based on what we know at this point.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, either to the testifier or to staff, I would imagine that there's a limited number corporations in Minnesota that pay this tax. Do we have an idea of how many businesses? I mean, $272 million by a very narrow band of corporations would seem to be a pretty significant hit. Do we know approximately how many corporations would be affected by this?
Assistant Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I don't think that's true. I can get you the number, but really take, for example, the royalty subtraction. Any company that files is required to file corporate taxes in Minnesota, which could include a lot of companies that are not have little payroll or property here, but they have nexus to Minnesota because of their sales into Minnesota and other reasons. If they have expenses that qualify for the foreign royalties subtraction, for example, they would also be able to benefit. So I can get the actual number for you. But I think it could potentially be Minnesota companies, non-Minnesota companies. I think it would be, I don't think that it would be a small number, but we'll get the.
Sure. Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman, to either testify, Representative Ward, Senior House staff, I would imagine that just because of the nature of the transactions, a small number of businesses would pay a vast majority of these taxes. Is that a fair statement, or is that not correct?
Assistant Commissioner? Or Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Groffel, it's a great question, and it's very hard to pin down because, you know, unlike, again, the 80s when this first became law in Minnesota, you know, you have companies that then have subsidiaries that have subsidiaries, and it goes on and on. So it's very difficult to sort of really pin down exactly, you know, who's paying what and how much because, I think corporate structures were a lot simpler 30 years ago when this first came up. So, you know, I'm concerned. Oftentimes you have foreign subsidiaries and subsidiaries of those companies that are the ones that are actually, impacted, and then that comes through to the parent company. So it's very difficult to pin down the number and who's not paying what.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, is this the same bill that we voted on? We voted on this last session on the House floor?
Representative Hornstein?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, it is, except for the countries that were deleted from the list.
Okay. All right.
Representative Garofalo?
And that's a statement, Mr. Chairman, and that is that You know, the author has stated that we, because of complex tax law, we may not know exactly who's paying this, and I'm assuming the people who are going to be affected by this are going to show up and tell us that this is a bad idea, and that would probably be a good idea for those people to get engaged in the legislative session and tell us what they think about this. So, thank you.
Thank you. What we'll do is we'll go, we've got the two testifiers supporting it, and then we've got some folks with concerns. I'd like to at least get the testimony in before noon if we could. And so let's do that. Let's get some more testimony, and then we will go to the folks with concerns, and then we'll have questions for whoever we have questions for. Then I would like to, we're probably not going to get to House Files 725 and 449, both members' bills. They are members of this committee, so we can look at those tomorrow. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions representing more than 300,000 working men and women across the state. And actually, I have to say that now we have reaffiliated with SEIU, so we have a few more members. Mr. Chair, if I may address the questions that were you kind of raised about the legality of the tax avoidance schemes. On the IRS website.
Schemes? We're obeying current law and their schemes?
That's actually what they call them on the IRS website. If you go to the IRS website, they call them tax avoidance schemes or tax havens. Yes.
So by obeying current law, we are now having schemes.
It's actually...
Okay. Why don't you get to your testimony, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. I'm going to start with that one. I'm sorry. Tax avoidance schemes allow multinational companies, CEOs, and wealthy individuals to benefit from our onshore benefits of tax, like our infrastructure, education, health care, and public safety that we've been fighting so hard to preserve, while using the offshore world to escape the responsibility to pay for it. Each year, major corporations and individuals avoid as much as $100 billion in federal taxes by offshoring the money they make here in the United States or by setting up sham headquarters in a tax haven country. According to the IRS, it is estimated...
Excuse me, Representative Hornstein, if you need to go to your bill, go ahead. I'll carry your bill here.
Okay, thank you.
It's in good hands. Yes. Ms. Schaubach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. According to the IRS, it is estimated that some $5 trillion in assets worldwide is held offshore in tax havens. The diversion ends up being shouldered by other companies and taxpayers. Individuals and companies all have to pay their taxes, but some of the world's wealthiest individuals and multinational companies able to afford ingenious lawyers and accountants have figured out ways to avoid paying enormous amounts of taxes. While we get into serious trouble for avoiding taxes, even face jail, some companies are able to get away with it. In response, governments tax the population further and try to make up for lost revenues from businesses that have evaded their taxes. The fact that America's companies were allowed to report less than half their actual U.S. profits to the IRS, while ordinary wage earners have to report every penny of their earnings, is just not fair. Tax is the forgotten element in the corporate social responsibility debate, and probably the most important. A responsible approach sees tax not as a cost to a company to be avoided, but like a dividend, a social distribution out of profits to all stakeholders. Companies do not make profits merely by using investors' capital. They also use the societies in which they operate, whether it be the physical infrastructure provided by the state or the people the state has educated. Tax is the return due on this investment by the society from which companies benefit. It is time once and for all to end this long-standing tax abuse. Ending this abuse shows that we are serious about taxation that is transparent, fair, and responsible. On behalf of the Minnesota AFL-CIO and working families, we ask you to support House File 665 and end this deceptive practice.
Thank you. Now by following the law, we are abusing the law. Okay, please, about a minute or two, and then we're going to go to some folks with concerns. State your name for the record and who you represent, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Thorson with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees.
John Thorson?
Correct.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Great, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here this morning to urge your support of House File 665 because tax havens distort our economy by favoring a handful of Wall Street and global corporations over thousands of Main Street businesses and community banks right here in Minnesota in two significant ways. The first, they foster an unlevel playing field that works against Minnesota businesses that shop locally, support our schools, provide jobs in their community, and responsibly pay their share of the taxes. And second, these tax havens allow the world's largest corporations to use our public infrastructure here in Minnesota on the cheap. For example, they work against community and regional banks that provide financing for local businesses, community development, pay taxes, yet these need to compete then against your large global banks and finance institutions that use the tax havens aggressively to reduce their taxes. They also work against local retailers throughout the state that then compete against big box retailers who take advantage of subsidiaries and tax havens to again reduce their tax burden here in Minnesota. And they work against Minnesota insurance companies forced to compete against global insurance companies that dodge tax through subsidiaries and tax havens in the nation's protectorates and principalities outlined in this bill. Further, aggressive corporate and individual tax dodging deprives our state of revenue needed to maintain, modernize, and reform the infrastructure and public services that are the underpinning of our communities, and shift the burden to Minnesota businesses and individuals that pay their fair share of taxes. Again, I encourage the chair and the committee to consider the provisions of House File 665 for inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, as they provide an opportunity for a proper accounting of the revenue. Some corporations hide through these practices and allow the state to increase today's investments in things that lead to prosperity for all Minnesotans. Investments in more jobs, better education, improved transportation, the health of our citizens, communities and environment, and the transformation of government services here in Minnesota.
Okay, so you said hiding, but they're legally hiding.
They are accounting, these are accounting practices that are not allowed.
So if it's legal, we're not really hiding because it's legal.
I presume current, this is, as Representative Fortenstein would say, this is a small tasteful tweak to the tax code that would allow Minnesota to capture some of these resources.
Whose taste? You said it's tasteful. Who's it tasteful to? My other thought is we've got a list here. My other question would be, we keep saying about, you know, they're using Minnesota resources, so if we would pass this bill, then everybody would stay here. Okay, I've got, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have about 5 minutes of questions, and then we're going to have the folks with concerns start off the meeting tomorrow. So I'm going to go Gottwald, Anderson, Bisgins, and Paymar. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually wanted to hear the full, I wanted to hear the pros and cons and then have some discussion about it. So my questions and comments will wait until we get that full testimony.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, Bisgins, Paymar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, appreciate you coming forward to give some testimony. But today, as we sit here in tax committee, we are learning that Hutchinson Technical Institute out of Hutchinson is closing up shop. They are moving their headquarters to Eau Claire. There's going to be about 30 to 40% of employees laid off from their company. And I think that we are sending a message to businesses here in the state of Minnesota that we don't want you to headquarter in Minnesota, that we don't think that you are doing enough. And as a result, we're losing businesses, we're losing jobs, we're losing the tax revenue from these folks, and just sending a message of, you know, our borders are closed to a healthy economy. And I have serious concerns about that, because we need to think about what these businesses do for this state. Not only is it the revenue that they currently provide, but also by having them here, it helps our consumers by having lower costs for consumer products that we provide to the citizens. And that hits the middle income and the lower income citizens. That's a key provision that we're missing out here when we're talking about the legislation that we have before us today. And not only that, we're also saying, okay, all these businesses that have been wonderful to the state and have contributed to the hockey team or the Rotary Club or you name it, any other kind of organization that we have in the state, we're saying we don't want you to contribute to the healthy community that we have in the state. We want you to headquarter somewhere else and send those dollars there. So I have real concerns with this bill and the message that we're sending to businesses, especially in light of that we're losing one more business today, HTI, to Wisconsin. I think that's sad.
Okay, so you don't like my bill that I'm coming
to
Representative Hornstein. Representative Bisgins, pay Marlesh. Representative Bisgins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I'm glad you are carrying the bill, I guess, because this isn't a question of the author of the bill, which you now are.
I'd love to answer the question.
You know, hearing the testimony and that we've got some tax dodging going on, and it sounds like this dodging is falling on the backs of individuals and small businesses throughout the state. Mr. Chair, looking at your bill, there seems to be a piece missing here then, because where's the corresponding tax cut for the individuals and small businesses that are right now apparently being undue burdened because we've got businesses who are actually following the law?
I think I'll go to Ms. Manzi.
No, Mr. Chair, that was rhetorical.
If I may.
Oh, that's rhetorical. Okay, let's go. Paymar, then Lash.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass. I just thought that my own opinion is that the witnesses, you know, were trying to present their opinion about a special tax treatment under the corporate franchise tax, and I just thought you were not being very good. I'm not going to say that. I mean, your opinion, they had some words that you didn't appreciate, but it is intimidating, and...
me intimidating, little old fuzzy ball me? Is that no. Did you feel intimidated, Ms. Shaba?
I always feel intimidated by you, Mr. Chair. I'm kidding.
Mr. Thorson, are you intimidated by me?
I'm doing okay this morning, thank you.
How'd you do yesterday?
Honestly, I'd feel better if Ruka Vina was here.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he intimidates me. Yeah, okay. Resident Paymar, I'm sorry that you feel that way, that any member, anyone that would feel that way before this committee. I think we've been very open with anybody being able to testify and been treated with great respect. Now, if we have a bill before us and I can't ask questions, well, I'm going to ask questions. Ms. Schaubach.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I can just address a couple of the comments by Representative Anderson and then by Representative Diskins, that would be
certainly
fabulous. As far as the company in Hutchinson that's moving to Wisconsin, under these provisions, my guess is, I'm not familiar with the company. I don't know how large it is. Chances are that this bill would not affect them, and in fact it would benefit them due to the I'm sorry, I'm going to use the word because that's actually what it is, the tax avoidance schemes. Those small businesses are paying five times as much as the larger corporations are in taxes. So there are benefits for the small businesses of Minnesota by making multinational corporations pay what they're supposed to be paying.
Okay, I'll go to Representative. We're going to run out here. Mr. Thorson and Ms. Shaba, could you come back to the beginning of the meeting without feeling too intimidated tomorrow?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
If you both could come back, I'd really appreciate that.
Sure.
And we will start with Lesh and Knuth, and then we'll go into the folks that have concerns, and then Gottwald has the first question after that. Good government, non-intimidating all the time. We are adjourned.